Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hey, it's Chris Burkhard, president and founder of Placer Staffing in the Mid-Atlantic.
Chris, thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast. Before we spend time talking about your current role, current organization, give us a thumbnail version of your career to date.
I'd be happy to. I'm kind of a rarity. I'm a fourth generation entrepreneur. Fourth generation. We've all been in Delaware, in the Mid-Atlantic, in the U.S., and it makes for a very unique upbringing because I was always told by like family members that security is working for myself. The exact opposite of how many people identify with work, right? You know, go work for a great company, have security, and, you know, kind of take care of yourself. So I grew up with a different mindset. And I've been in the family business and been an entrepreneur for over 20 years myself.
That's super exciting, and I appreciate the background. Seems like a very diverse background. So tell us a little bit more about MyPlacers. How did you come about getting that started, and what's the overall mission?
Sure. So I've been in the human capital space for 30 years. I don't really know what else to call it. Some people call it, you know, staffing. They call it search. They call it headhunting. You know, it's got all kinds of different names. And I guess maybe this would be interesting in working for my father first. You know, you get to know a business, a way of thinking. I learned to lead, to sell, to run a staffing firm. But when I left that business, I wanted to do something else. And I interviewed a whole bunch of entrepreneurs and found out their story and actually wanted to open a commercial cleaning company. And I wanted to maybe do a nursery with plants and stuff like that. And I learned a valuable lesson. Banks don't lend you money on what you want to do. They lend you money on what you know. So for me, I had another business plan on staffing. And, I thought that was my chance to diversify. But it was really kind of neat that you learn that first lesson is, you know, people know that you know how to make money, you know the business model, you know how to do things in that particular area. So actually, coming out of staffing, I saw that it was a time where a lot of businesses were being acquired. There was a lot of roll-ups going on. So I started my business the morning of 9/11, believe it or not. My first employee started at 8:45. I mean, obviously, what an event in world history and American history. It's my own unique part of it. Obviously, it was, here I am gambling with every nickel I have to tell everybody the story of my company. And all of a sudden it was un-American to sell. So we literally sat on our hands and, as I said, built forms and built processes for 90 days and just, you know, introduced ourselves to everybody. But what I saw was all those roll-ups and all those acquisitions, there was not a lot of room for traditional staffing. It took a lot of capital. You need a lot of credit to fund payroll. But I saw organizations looking for flexibility in how they hired their direct core staff. And, you know, they didn't necessarily, they say people are their core competency, but, you know, they launch a new product and need to hire 100 salespeople. They're not built for that. Or they ramp up manufacturing and need to hire 1,000, you know, machine operators. They're not built for that. So I saw an opportunity, and I was one of the early forefathers into what today is the recruitment process outsourcing industry. It's part of business process outsourcing. So my roots were always in solving the customer's human capital problem and just building a model to do it. Today, I run a total talent solutions company. It's Placer's Staffing. We have all these capabilities where we talk to customers about what ails them, and we just put together models to help address it. Total Talent Solutions is, if you and I are looking for a customer service job, an accountant, the process to get a job to be a contractor is exactly the same to join the company on a core or direct level. I've got to go through interviews. I probably have to use Zoom, you know. I've got to do a background. I might have to go get a drug test depending on where it is. I got to go through the same onboarding. But what customers need is a way to say, you know what? I want Chris to be a temporary. I want John to be a direct hire. I want they need that flexibility. So that's kind of what I do, is create programs that give them, you know, control over that, because it's not what they do. They know they need to have labor costs be flexible, but there's a host of compliance and scalability issues that make it really hard.
Wow, that's what a story. And I don't even know where to start, but thank you for sharing that. Very exciting. So with you being in the industry for quite some time, you've seen the industry go through different trends, different cycles, and whatever the case may be. As of right now, what are the different trends and ideas that really excite you these days from human capital, talent acquisition space? What are you researching? What's in the Chris's next big thing book?
Yeah, I think you've nailed it with the next big thing book. I feel like the space that we're all in is that we're at a fascinating intersection. Maybe our aunts and our uncles and our grandparents, they worked for one company for 30 years, start in the mailroom, got their gold watch. I know it's not the reality of where we are all today, but I have to tell you, with companies not playing the parental role managing careers, who is managing careers? I see an opportunity that the workforce needs a coach or an agent or whatever you want to call it, somebody to just help navigate their career. And the, you know, they're going to have different jobs, they're going to change industries, they're going to change job titles, but there's very little help there. Companies don't want to do it anymore. The workforce doesn't have the skill. So I think our opportunity is, could placers do that? I'm not sure. I just saw something wild. I hope it's okay to use a brand name. Microsoft Teams, it's more of a tech comment, for one additional dollar now has a coaching model for those in higher education. It's unbelievable. It's like a whole platform to help someone navigate their career. Like it's my big idea, but somebody finally did it. And it's just fascinating to see, because I think maybe that's what we all need to do, is pay a couple of bucks a month and get someone to be an agent for us. That's one crazy thing. The other, I mean, technology. I'm not a believer that technology is going to like replace jobs. What I see, it's giving an opportunity for talented people to do higher value work. If things can be automated to get schedules done, to get questions answered, I mean, that's just baseline stuff. If my workers or other workers in the talent acquisition field can then spend time on higher value tasks, I view it as a great opportunity. And, you know, I'm not that old. I'm 52 years old. But when I started this damn business, I had to go drop 15 grand on a phone system that mounted on a wall and had a bunch of copper and all that stuff. And you know what I'm talking about? Today, you can turn your phone on with your laptop in an hour. But there were real barriers to entry that technology has taken away. And that's what I love about it. Because, you know, those were real limiters, because it took real cash to get some of that old fashioned stuff in place. You know, remember when we had servers in our office? I do.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are great, exciting stories. And, you know, I talk to a lot of talent acquisition, thought leaders from different, eras, so to say. And I've heard some stories about faxing resumes and things like that. So that's pretty interesting.
I'll go a step further. We had a courier on staff. Pre-fax, you ran the resumes around to the law firms and to employers all day long. He ran. So, I mean, it's just a fun story. Yeah. I'm in an industry in talent acquisition that has too much turnover in my book. You can't go to college and get a degree in talent acquisition and recruiting. Unfortunately, you know, you get some certifications and that's okay. So one of the things I think is our industry's got to do a better job of out training everybody else. So I've set a crazy goal to to train all staff 142 hours a year, all staff. And it takes a lot of time, energy, money, and resources. But to me, I think these are unique times, and there's a lot of talk that people are going to really jump around, and you know, they're calling it what, the Great Resignation, you know, that kind of thing. But I think if you can remind people that they still have something they can learn from you, maybe they stick around.
Right, right. Absolutely. The great, you know, I love that term. That's pretty interesting. So with, you know, as we talk about the different trends and where the just the overall, you know, the industry is going, one term that, you know, we've been hearing a lot lately, especially coming out of pandemic and this year and, you know, past, future of work, in a sense, you know, the gig workers, freelancers, the overall contingent workforce trend that's been growing. What are your thoughts on that? Where do you see that going? Because, you know, I as I collaborate with a lot of executives at organizations of different size, it's one common trend is that organizations, they definitely seek that flexibility to be able to scale up or down in a very efficient manner. So talk to us a little bit about the future of work.
Well, it's interesting. It was, I think, 1995 when the pundits started to talk about that up to 50% of all workers would be defined as a contingent worker, you know, freelance, independent contractor, outsourced, temporary, you know, gig worker, early retiree, intern, whatever you want to call that flexible worker. One of the things I think that's happened is that the demographics and the pandemic have just wreaked havoc on all of that. Labor participation and available labor are at lows last seen since like 1988. You know, gosh, I think I was in college when it's been this low. So there's been a lot of changes on the supply side that I think are temporary supply side issues, but they've been really significant. What is happening is a number that banged around in the 20s, the percentage of people, you know, one in four, is closer to 40%. And I see it accelerating to 50%. What's interesting is people know they need it and they're striving to do it. It's really successful in the large Fortune 500, but when you get below that, there's a struggle to know how to organize the size and magnitude of that program, compliance, visibility, you know, making sure that the information is accessible, that there's good processes around it. It's one thing to say I want 1,000 freelance contingent workers. It's another thing to manage it all and not have 1,000 bills. So it's created a really unique business problem for businesses. It's created new roles, new departments. It's starting to spin out of HR. It's starting to spin out of procurement and get its own identity as a career. And I think it should. You know, we call it MSP, but someone who sits, you know, in kind of a vendor neutral capacity to help an organization get all the veins of talent that it needs. I think that's going to continue to grow. And a lot of the models that have been in place have been based on spend. I think you're starting to see good software and good programs that are not driven by spend, but based on the reality that it's so important to a business to do it. Smaller businesses don't have the scale and are really struggling with this point. How do I get enough of the right talent? You know, and how many of us are confused? How many leaders say that people are our competency? Well, that may be true in something. If you're an engineering firm, you better make sure engineering's your competency, or, you know, maybe you're a sales company and that's your thing. But I don't know if you need one graphic design person a year, that's your competency. And how do you find them, track them, and all that stuff? So it's an interesting place to be, because it's what people are talking about at cocktail parties, but they don't have the methodology to pull it off.
Right. Absolutely. No, that, you know, we could probably talk about this particular topic the rest of the episode, because it's such a broad area and it's been growing pretty tremendously the past couple of years, even before the pandemic. I think that's very interesting how things play out in the next, you know, year or so, because it's just so many unknowns in this particular market. And with the whole kind of war for talent out there and the next level, the war on retention, so to say, that's what I wanted to get, you know, your opinions on in the sense, as you collaborate and work with your client companies and you help them, you know, build these cultures of innovation, foster that environment through exceptional candidates. Talk to us about practical recommendations that you provide to them when it comes to retaining the top talent.
So if you're comfortable with it, I'll blend it with a bit of future of work stuff, if that's okay with you.
I love that. If you can do that, I think that would be money.
That would be money. All right. Well, then I have to deliver for you, brother. I have to. So now the challenge is there. So what the pandemic has accelerated something, and I'm sure you're going to identify with companies or leaders that are struggling with this right now. And it's, I mean, you've been entrepreneurial too, I think, right? You've built some things. So the value of your contribution versus an hour worth of work, like, I think that is so big for leaders and workers right now. You know, in the entrepreneurial approach, you're 5 people or 50 people, you need your people to do something magical today, this week. They got to contribute. You're not saying come to work 8 to 5. You're saying solve big problems, do great code, sell something big, like change our trajectory, and we'll reward you for that. Well, all of a sudden, all these folks are thrust at home and people are still trying to count my damn hours worked, you know, versus my contribution, my output, my outcomes. And yes, I'm blending work from home with the future of work, but the reality of retention here is, as leaders, we need to shift very quickly to that entrepreneurial mentality of the outcomes that you produce, the value you create, not counting a goddamn clock of whether you punched in at 8 and left at 5. And excuse the French, but you know, it's relevant in this. So that's a really big thing. The other thing is, most of the roles that we create are actually projects. They're not really jobs. They have a beginning and an end. And how that's changing work and organizations and things around retention, it's how we organize labor. A lot of folks, my dad used to say, if you looked at your job in the last year, so let your audience think about their job. In a knowing way, how many times were you congruent with that job last year, where you were just like, yeah, this is me, I've got it. This is perfect. This is what it's all about. And then how many times did you think, like, wow, they notice I don't have a lot to do? They notice that my thing's kind of seasonal and it's kind of dipped. Like, very few times are jobs and people married in that way all the time. And it's probably because if we really looked at it, there's a cyclical nature to work, and projects have a beginning and an end. And, you know, people just put too much value on that title versus the work and contribution that they do. So what am I seeing with retention? Leaders that do not give flexibility are going to be the ones without. That flexibility is empathy. It's understanding. It's being able to get out of your own head and your own pain and say, are you okay? How do I get you through this? Because there's a lot of folks that feel like they weren't really heard and taken care of during this pandemic. I'm not saying it's true or not. I'm telling you what I'm studying and how it fits, and that organizations are winning the retention battle by thinking about how they can show empathy and be flexible, specifically a hybrid model, having people re-enter. I think you'll find this funny. We had a manufacturing worker interview for a job, manufacturing worker, who asked if he could have the accommodation to work from home. I haven't figured out how to do that yet, you know. It's, but I, But what I took from it was not in any way to disrespect him. It's that that individual wanted that flexibility. His skills are in warehousing, but he's heard about this flexibility thing where he can take dogs to vets and be there for sick kids, but it's not his skills. He's going to have to upskill and change it. And that was the conversation. You can have that, but you're going to have to upskill. You got to grow staff through learning and development. I touched on it. Those that view that as a waste or an expense versus an investment are going to lose people, because people want to learn and grow, and they want someone that knows how to help them do that, or at least cares that they're on that journey. And then there's this reality that I keep saying, all that's fine and good, Burkhard, but you better have competitive offerings with pay and benefits and programs, because this is a time where the workforce is in charge and doesn't know it. And if I can get another dollar down the street, why not? That's the American way.
Yeah, those are great examples. And thank you for consolidating that, because at the end of the day, it's an interesting dynamic, right? And as you collaborate, which leads me to the further point I want to make, as you collaborate with both sides of the equation, with the hiring managers and the candidates on both sides, when it comes to preparing, you know, both parties for that first interview, talk to us about the strategies that really help you, you know, improve or increase your batting average when it comes to preparing the hiring manager for the interview and also the candidate, setting the right expectations. What else goes into that preparation process? How do you go about that?
So, you know, first off, I think to understanding what the definition of success is in the equation that you talked about of having a hiring manager and an applicant interview, I was always taught that is that you have to eliminate all distractions so that those two people can have a dialogue, you know, that you just eliminate, you know, and you know, you go in that 1,000 different directions, but, you know, somebody, I'll give you an example of one, a person has a handbag, male or female, but it's banging against the arm of the chair during the interview. And I'm the interviewer, and all I'm thinking about is that person going to take that handbag off because it's just banging on that thing. I could be the greatest candidate on the planet, but all I hear is this damn banging of that. And, you know, the person just says, you know, I just didn't feel right. It's just not right for me. So eliminating those barriers, and the way we do that is we are very methodical with the preparation and briefing of both the hiring manager and the individual. We want them to have all the information that we have so that they can prepare. And it's a labor of love, because not everybody wants to participate that way, but it's very, it's detailed information. It's also, you know, we're very honest with hiring managers about areas of weakness or vulnerability with the candidate. We'd like to go right at that. You know, you'll notice that Chris had a gap in his employment for 90 days. Let me explain specifically what he did with that time. You know, so we're very honest with it. We don't hide that stuff. And then the third point is we have to be very careful, because people don't like to feel like they're being directed by a puppet on strings. Hiring managers are like, well, you made that person better than they are. No, what we did was give them the information they need to be a better interviewer, because they don't do that for a living. They need coaching, because they're a good employee, but they're a terrible interviewer. We have to help them get better at that. So it's eliminate barriers, labor of love, give the details, and the devil was in the details on that.
Right, absolutely. Those are great examples, because at the end of the day, there's no specific formula for that, right? It's the art and the science, and there's so many variables that could be out of, you know, at least your control when it comes to people in general. I think that's very interesting.
But you control what you can. If your checklist says, hey, Burkhard, I want you to take a ride the day before, take the bus day before, look where the plant is. You'll notice where the parking is. You'll notice, hey, take note where you go in under visitors. Notice that it takes 20 minutes to get through visitors there. I need you there at 8:30 for your 9 o'clock interview. Go in at 8:40. You know, so you can do those things so that folks don't make the human error mistakes that we all make every day. And of course, that just screws you up with the process. But you're right, you can't control everything. We do always say that people do people things. Just got to do one more thing right than wrong today, you know, to keep on the positive side of the ledger.
Right. I like that saying, people do people things. It's pretty cool. Simple, but very oftentimes overlooked as well, right? So in terms of just the talent acquisition, and for a lot of companies, especially in the fully remote environment, they thought, or at least that was a perception, that we're now going to get access to all these great candidates all over the world on a global scale. It's going to be very easy. I'm not restricted geographically just to my location. I can now hire all over the place. But competition also 10x'd during that period as well, because companies, much bigger, much better packages targeting exactly the same candidates. So what's your play there as you collaborate with your partner companies, your clients, when it comes to attracting the top talent in these very unique candidate-driven environments? What are the different creative ways that really help you succeed from that perspective?
But it's the most popular question I get. I feel like I answer it all day long. And maybe it's all the time, but boy, is it accelerated, you know, in terms of its frequency. It's sort of coming out this way. Everything we're doing isn't working. So what else do we do? And I've been trying to kind of use this way, this example of thinking about it. You know, sometimes it's hard to sell stuff, right? It's a salesperson, it's hard to sell stuff. So you got to really look at your sales and marketing plan for recruiting and think about all the places that talent hangs out. And we talk, there's high value and low value sourcing. And what I find is organizations want to do high value sourcing. And it's no different than a salesperson cherry picking on what they think is best in their pipeline. But high value is where you post it and you post it and pray. And normally I get a bunch of people, 20, 30, 40, 50 people to look through. It keeps me busy, lots of activity. And the reality is the high value stuff. By the way, the high value stuff is the high return on investment stuff. So people want to do it because it's a better value. I get that. But the reality is the high value stuff isn't working. So you're talking about how everybody had this idea that the whole world is their buffet and that they can recruit from everywhere. I have to tell you, I saw a lot of leadership teams not be able to get out of their own way and come up with new strategies and approval processes to do so. So 1 in 4 companies lost that opportunity, or they're still thinking about it. And of course they lost the opportunity to do this. The other that I'm seeing is that organizations are looking at markets that are kind of your middle of the road markets. And they're where they're choosing to, so they're not looking for the best at any price, but let's say the strategy I would deploy, I'm looking to hire 15 recruiters in the next 6 months, but maybe I look at, everybody picks on Cleveland. I think I can get away with this. Maybe I look at Cleveland and a couple of other small markets where a recruiter salary might be 10 grand less than San Francisco, or 20 grand less than DC and New York. But I'm seeing a lot of folks look at salary demographics and then go get professional talent in smaller markets and then apply it back to their regular market. Is it any difference than offshoring? Well, it's different, isn't it? This remote work has enabled me to look at North America and go find the talent where salaries are a little undervalued and then apply them to my business. And it's worked with great success. We've picked up people, not a lot, but more than 5 that are all over the marketplace. And you know, they get great value because they can't find the job in their home market.
Right. What are the most in-demand skill sets that you're seeing that are very scarce these days, you know, in your space in particular?
So I'll answer to my space and I'll give just not in my space. And this is not a fun answer, but it's the facts, is that Over the last 15 months, anything defined as an essential worker, e-commerce, supply chain, truck drivers, frontline workers and some things, an e-commerce worker, the job ads are up 330%, and the number of jobs are up 500% in the last 15 months. Anybody that wants to work in a warehouse for Amazon or Walmart or fill in the blanks has that job. And of course, there's been wage inflation to it. But that with the disruption of the world and so many people working from home, that has been we made up 10 years worth of growth, and it's why Amazon hired a million workers, right? I mean, that has been so profound that it's been a shift. You know, part of our business in manufacturing and light industrial, that has been a profound shift, and it's challenging. The other that is not my market, but travel nursing, per diem nursing, is just off the charts. So healthcare staffing, not anything I cover, I wish I was, frankly, because it's up between 30% and 60%, and that's just not a number that even a high-performing company like mine can touch. That's a huge growth number. And that's the industry. There's even some flyers that are way above that.
Yeah, those are very, very interesting perspectives. And absolutely, in this current market, it's interesting to observe that, especially how companies go about, you know, seeking or even finding that scarce talent. It's very, you know, got to be very creative in this particular environment. So from the other area I want to cover is also the sources that you utilize on a daily basis to, you know, keep yourself informed, keep yourself ahead of the curve. What are you reading? What are you consuming? What's your content diet is looking like?
You know, I love that question. Appreciate it. Someone long ago asked me about my tower of guilt. And I looked at him funny, and it's like, and then like a light bulb, I'm not so quick. I was like, oh, you mean how many books I have in queue that I haven't read? And of course, it can be on Kindle too, right? It's just the ones that stack up, or your Audible books or whatever, you know? So I think if you were ever going to tease me or make a caricature of me, I can guarantee you there'd be a book in my hand. I'm a bookworm in that regard. I probably read 1 to 2 books per week. It is how I get out of my own head, and separate myself from the business and those things. So I would say this, I know it's popular among entrepreneurs, but I've become kind of a closet stoic. I'm a huge fan, and I consume a lot of Ryan Holiday. I really enjoy his stuff. Stillness is the key. Obstacle is the way. I'm that entrepreneur that tried to control everything. And then I read the principle that you can only control your own mind, like not even your own body. And that blew me away. Such an obvious thing, but I tried to control the world for most of my life. And I'm probably a happier and better human when I realized that I don't have that gift or that right. I have lots of recommendations, self-help and those things. Zen and the Art of Happiness. It's not really a religious book. It's just, I think it's a great book if you get down. My most impactful book is Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl. If you don't know that one, I highly recommend it. It sounds like an awful topic. It is about the concentration camps, but it's not about the events. It's about the study of how people either got through or didn't get through that experience, and how, and it's just a magnificent study about human beings and what we do and how we react under difficult circumstances. And the all-time favorite, I think I built my culture and my whole way of being, is I'm a bit old school, Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. I literally feel like it's how, as a young professional, I learned to think about my interactions with others and how to create value for them. I don't know if your audience will see it. I've got 1,000 books around me. It's sort of just the way it is, but.
Yeah.
We have a quick shout out to a friend, Arnie Malham. He has a business called A Better Book Club. You should interview him. He's a big guy with culture, but he's done this cool piece of software where you list all your books and you pay people to read them. And so it can be, you know, you can sort of, what would the word be? You could put together tracks if you want people to learn about business or sales or culture. But that's been a huge part of my culture. You know, if we're all knowledge workers, like this proves it, you know, pick your own books, read them. I'll pay you to read them. But, you know, let's face it. When we read, we do learn, and it makes the world really small. And you start to realize that what's in one book is in another book. And that's the whole point of it.
Right, right. No, I love these recommendations. And for our, they, you know, we do have the video versions of these, so they'll definitely see your background as well, which is pretty cool. And we'll list these titles in the show notes. Chris, I can't thank you enough for your insights today. Very short and, you know, conversation. I personally learned quite a bit. What I love doing with all the guests is do a follow-up episode in about a year and see how much of change transpired. We will revisit the conversation from a year ago and see, you know, see how much have changed since then. So I'm definitely looking forward to that.
Thanks for putting up with me. I appreciate your thoughtful questions. And yeah, I'm not sure what kind of a futurist I am, but I think it's we live in interesting times.
Right, right, absolutely. So I definitely thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.